art transforms people. It changes people. It heals people. We have a world that's full of frustration and heartache, and art helps. And it's our job as artists to get out there in the street and get our medicine to the people who need it, not for those people who are depressed on the couch, who are stricken with grief, who are bedridden, to find ways to find us.
This is the Cracking Creativity Podcast, episode number 42 with Charlie Gilkey. Welcome to the Cracking Creativity Podcast. I'm your host, Kevin Chung, and I'm here to show you how creatives turn their ideas into action, create interesting projects, and build an engaged audience through shared passions. Now let's get creative. In this episode of the Cracking Creativity Podcast, I talked to Charlie Gilkey, who is the creator of Productive Flourishing and the host of the Creative Giants Podcast. Charlie describes himself as the result of mashing up an entrepreneur, army officer, and philosopher. He is another one of the great people that I met at World Domination Summit last year, and he has a lot to offer for artists and creatives of every kind. In it, Charlie talks about mindsets, business, and the power of art. Now on to the episode. Welcome to another episode of Cracking Creativity. Today I'm on Charlie Gilkey. He is the creator of Productive Flourishing. He is the host of the Creative Giant Show, and he has written for multiple publications, including Mashable, Washington Post, Inc., Huffington Post, and other sites like BAT. And I love his description on his website. If a mad scientist were to do a Freaky Friday experiment and cross an entrepreneur, army officer, and philosopher, that's what you would get. Charlie, can you tell us a little bit more about yourself and some of what you're doing?
First, thanks so much for having me on the show today, Kevin. So, it's always challenging to mention, kind of talk about my past, because there's this bit of parallel development, you know, with what you just mentioned between being in the Army and being a philosophy graduate student and working towards completing my PhD and then being an entrepreneur. So there's that parallel development that happened there. Really what I'm working on now, though, is I'm working on a mainstream published book, actually the book proposal for that. We're going to be starting to do some more events for our audience, who we call Creative Giants. We're going to be amping up the frequency and formats, or changing the formats for the Creative Giant Show, as you mentioned. There's just a lot of content and workflows and product stuff that we have in the background that we're going to be rolling out too. So, yeah, it's just one of those things. I stay pretty in the flow of creativity and business and conversation.
Cool. How did you go from being an army officer and philosophy major to being an entrepreneur? Were they all happening simultaneously?
There was a period in time where I was all three at once, which is crazy making. Never do that. Never, ever do that. So the thing about it is I didn't really know about blogging and sort of this world, this digital world that we lived in, until about 2005. And I was like, oh, so people are using blogs and stuff to teach online. That's kind of cool. I was a teacher as a philosophy instructor and really as a military leader. A lot of times you end up in a teaching format anyways. Been teaching for a long time. And so I saw it as a way, as a platform to teach these different things that I was running about that I couldn't find anywhere else. And my challenge was at the time that on the one hand, I had this really great skill set about moving equipment and troops and getting missions done. Yet I was struggling to complete my, you know, academic papers. And it was really like, what's going on with that? I can move battalions, but I can't finish a 5,000-word essay that I know how to write. It's not like I didn't have the capability. So what's going on? So I started doing like any good nerd will do, is I started reading what other people were doing. And so I stumbled upon, you know, the greats, the 7 Habits. Actually, I'd read the 7 Habits earlier, but I started really getting serious about getting things done and Seven Habits and all those great books like that. And they just, they weren't doing it for me. They didn't talk about it from a creative perspective, like what it was like to have this, these ideas inside you and need to get them in the world. And they didn't supply enough of sort of that goal-oriented or that mission-focused bias towards action. And, you know, Dave Allen, I love getting things done. I love the work that he's done. And what I lost with his work was the coherence on my big goal. So I was getting more stuff done. Like I had a really clear to-do list in my inbox, but I wasn't making significant progress on my best work. It didn't help me out with that. So I started writing about that at what became Productive Flourishing. There were two ugly, terribly named sites before Productive Flourishing. So that's kind of how that all started. And I kept writing and people started liking it. And this was back in the days, this will date me in the blogosphere, but this was back in the days of Dig. And like, I even think MySpace was still open then, right? This was before social media. And so it kind of grew from there. And then I knew before too long that like the academic pathway was not for me. For a lot, not that it was bad. I'm not one of those entrepreneurs that hated my job before I started and like, I hate my job and I had to do something different. It wasn't so much that, but just like, I noticed that with what I was doing with Productive Flourishing, that I got to live a more full contact life. I got to live more in 3D and I really liked that. So it was a better situation for me. And then in 2010, when I moved from Nebraska to Oregon, that's also when I resigned my commission as a Army officer, because again, the business had incorporated so much of who I was, what I could do, what I couldn't do and what I needed to learn all in one handy little, you know, little slash big business. And so that's how I kind of either took off, if you wanted to say it that way, or that's how I kind of landed from three different major careers or dimensions of life to just one.
Did you build your business based upon what you were doing at Productive Flourishing?
Did I build the business based upon what I was doing?
Or were you contacting people on a different – like how did you actually create a business from where you were to where you are now?
Accidentally. I didn't – you know, I knew that you could make money with blogging and stuff. But I didn't set up to be a, you know, business strategy coach. I didn't go into that. I have, to this day, no formal business training. And so I was like, why would you want to hire me? Go hire an MBA. Well, I figured out why you wouldn't want to go hire an MBA. And so what happened was I was going along and people had projects. You know, business is just, it's just all about projects that you got to get to market. And so people would have ideas and not know how to do anything with them, or to use my language, they wouldn't know how to convert their idea into a project. So they talked to me about it and, you know, I'd help them scope out the project and plan it and figure out the right ways to do it and figure out all the hard ways that they were currently doing the project. And it, to be honest, Kevin, it was one of those things where it's like, I would talk to people and they were like, well, can you help me with that? I'm like, sure. Right. It's just all this stuff. But then when they started talking about like, it's business, I'm like, I really don't know anything about business. But I can help you with that project. And there was a certain point in which people started asking me like, so when can we meet next? And I'm like, what do you mean meet next? Like we just had will you coach me? And I'm like, what do you mean? Will I coach you? I'm not trained as a coach either. Right. I'm not trained as a coach. I'm not trained in business. And I don't say that with pride because I know a lot of people have spent a lot of money, and a lot of hard work getting their credentials as a, as an MBA or getting a, degree in business administration or coaching. So I'm not trying to deride any of that. I'm just trying to say that wasn't my pathway. So when people were asking me to do things that required those specialties, I was like, what are you talking about, bruh? Like, that's not what I do. Right. But eventually it turned into paid offers and products and speaking and events. And it's just kind of grown that way, man.
Right. People often look at the end result, so they look at where you are now and just assume that you had always been this person who knew everything, but they didn't realize you didn't even want to go into business. You were just dabbling into blogging, and somehow people just gravitated towards you.
Yeah, and to be clear, I don't know everything, or I don't have it all figured out now by a long shot, right? So it's one of those things where I had my first sort of marketing coach and marketing buddy. She was like, Charlie, you do everything wrong, and it's infuriating because it works. And at the what I would say now is that I've always been a keen strategic thinker. You can edit this if it's not going to make any sense whatsoever. But, you know, if you read something like Sun Tzu's The Art of War, he talks about knowing the conventional and the unconventional, and knowing when you're doing something that's the conventional approach and how easily defeatable that is, and knowing when you need to use an unconventional approach. And sometimes when those unconventional approaches then become conventional, that you doing the conventional thing becomes unconventional. So, I mean, it gets really funny in a way like that, but I would look at the way people were doing things, and I was more driven by, really how am I going to serve people with this? How am I going to do this in a way that really fires me up? And, as it became a business, you know, I was speaking at Simple Rev, which is a conference hosted by Joel Zavlosky. I don't know how to say his last name. SimpleRev.com at Minneapolis. And there's someone who asked me, like, did anything change when it became your lifestyle or the way of making a living between, like, just blogging and sharing stuff versus earning from it? And I was like, yeah, it does. It does change that. You lose a little bit of the freedom to just do whatever you want, right? It becomes harder because you have to start thinking about, will this actually earn revenue? And you kind of go through cycles where when you recognize that what you're doing is actually helping people, and you get paid to help people, that you take it more seriously in a way. Because if I can sort of dilly-dally over here with something that's kind of nerdy cool to me, but it doesn't actually help people, that comes at a cost. I'm not trying to say that it's always like I write the practically useful stuff that someone else needs, but it's just a different consideration than when it's just a hobby that's all about that really nerdy, cool thing that you like, you know? Mm-hmm. A long, rambling answer, so there we go.
Have you always been a like problem solver since you were like young? Is that something that people attributed towards you?
Yeah, well, I grew up very poor, and when you grow up poor, you either learn to be you learn resourcefulness so that you don't remain poor, or you learn other things. I'll not talk about the other things. I learned resourcefulness, and I learned like that just because whatever the situation I was handed was a certain way, that didn't mean that it needed to stay that way. So I've always kind of had that problem solving. If something doesn't suit me or something doesn't fit right, I'm always looking like, how can I change that to be a little bit better, to serve its purpose a little bit better, so on and so forth. I mean, simple example. I was thinking about this the other day because other people wouldn't do it. I was flying back and we were hanging out in the Delta Sky Club thing. And we were sitting there and they had these desks, these chairs that had these little like armrest that turned into desk things. But the problem was the sun was behind us, and so we were going to sit in the window with the chairs that had the desk in it and have the back of our necks fried and be squinting at our screen all day. And I looked across the way, and they had these other chairs that didn't have the little desk things on there, which we both wanted. So, you know, rather than like trying to find another place where it had different chairs, I just rearranged the room. So that the chairs that we wanted were facing away from the sun, or, you know, that we were over the other side of the room, so we weren't getting neck burns and weren't looking at a screen. Now, that's not a big deal to think about it, right? It's a fairly simple solution to a problem. But there are a lot of people who wouldn't have seen that, and if they saw it, wouldn't have done it, right? Because, oh, you can't move the furniture. That's what the person I was with is like, is it okay if we move the furniture? I'm like, well, if it's not okay, they'll come over and tell us. But I'm not going to sit here and get burned all day, like, wondering. Like, let's change it. So I think when we talk about creativity, I'm a huge advocate for everyday creativity like that, like the everyday creativity that the sandwich artist at Subway has to you know, put the bell peppers three containers to the right because that's, you know, makes more sense and things like that. I think we are all inevitable. We are all inherently creative. We are all inherently problem solvers. It's just that some people use that skill and cultivate it more than others.
I also think that is true because you can take creativity and apply it to just about any business or any situation or any occupation. And people have this idea that creativity is just for, you know, artists or actors and musicians or whatever. And they, by just thinking that, they limit themselves and what they're able to accomplish.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, and there are times in which whether you're a painter or I'll use the word artist here, right? So many people who have creative skills, like, get that fear of, like, the fraud police about calling themselves an artist because they're not featured somewhere or they're not as good as their person or so on and so forth, right? And there's all this sort of story around what it means to be an artist that I think is fundamentally unhelpful. And so sometimes the best thing you can do is sort of drop that artist label and say, I'm a painter. Now, what's the difference? Well, what makes you a painter is that you paint. That's it, right? Now, on the other hand, what makes you an artist is that you make art. But that art piece, that's really, like, subjective. Like, is this art or is this painting? Like, all that sort of stuff comes up. So if you ever feel in that, just like, you know, you don't feel like the artist thing or that's keeping you, like, you're a writer. You're a writer because you sit down and write. You're a painter because you sit down and paint. You're a photographer because you take pictures, right? And then as you get your confidence and competence there, then maybe at some point you want to call yourself an artist. But if it's useful to focus on the craft that you do rather than the evaluation of that craft, which is sometimes where we get confused with artists, then just focus on the craft.
Why do you think there is that story about being an artist and the, like, that tag adds so much weight to people?
I think it's because I won't go on a mini riff. I'll say there's part of it that comes from an academic intellectual culture that has defined what art is. And so, you know, there's writing and then there's Shakespeare, you know, there's painting and then there's Monet, right? You can go through all those different things and you're like, oh, those guys, those are artists. I'm just little old me. Right. And so I think that's part of it, but I think it's part of the challenge of being an artist is it's an invitation to be seen. When you use that word, it's an invitation for people to, like, evaluate your work. And a lot of times as a creative person, it's hard to be seen in that way, even though that's fundamentally one of our core needs, especially some types of creatives where that's just a drive to be seen and appreciated and to see that this thing that you've made is beauty. And so there's a lot of schizophrenia in there, man. It really is. We want to be seen, but we're scared about being seen. And I think there's also enough in our culture around, you know, being an artist, especially if you want to be a full-time artist, that inevitably means that you're broke, right? Because artists don't make money, right? You'd go do something like adult, like be an engineer or a doctor or a lawyer or, you know, even a brick mason, right? That's a respectable adult career. Being an artist, I mean, you wake up at 11:30 with a black beret on and you paint for 4 hours and then you drink wine and cheese and read, you know, Nietzsche. Is that really what it's, you know? And granted, it sounds funny, but there's just those sort of weird images we have of what it means to be an artist and what it means to be a creative that is just fundamentally unhelpful.
Yeah, I think artists also have the idea that when they create, they shouldn't need to sell it because they're doing it for the act itself. But if they want to continue to do it, there's no other way unless you have somebody paying you for it in some form or fashion.
Yeah, you know, I sometimes think this whole art is a process thing can be a huge way of hiding. It's an excuse to hide. because, and granted, I'm a writer, I'm a creative, I play music by myself, or I play, you know, I'm an amateur musician. And so there's a part of it where I really, really understand the process of creativity, or for a Canadian, the process of creativity. So I get that. And at a certain point, though, I see people use, like, it's about the process as a way to avoid finishing their work and a way to avoid shipping that work to a marketplace. So I just want to call that out. Like, just notice that in yourself when, like, the appeal to the process is actually you giving yourself permission to not finish that work and not share that work with other people because you're scared of being seen and you're scared of their judgment about that and you're scared about its sellability, so on and so forth. So, you know, use your your mileage may vary with that one, but at least look at the meter.
Mm-hmm. What do you think people can do to change their mindset about that finishing and the process versus, you know, being ready to display your work or show your work to people?
Yeah, I think the first thing here is to recognize that what actually shows up in the world is more beautiful than that perfect image that you have in your head. I think a lot of artists have enough perfectionism in them that they can't let it go until it's perfect. And that piece of art that you're creating, it can't change and inspire people if they don't see it, right? Mm-hmm. It can't be that shared beauty in the world if you hide it in the closet because you're waiting for it to be perfect. Way, way better for this really excellent painting or this really excellent art that you've created to be in the world so people can enjoy it and be healed by it than for it to be sitting in your studio, you know, so you can find that perfect color of red to go in this, you know, quarter inch of a palette right there, right? So mm-hmm. I think that's one of those things is that we assume that perfection in our mind is better, but actually the change that art has on people is fundamentally of a different level of importance than just the beauty in our minds. So that's one. Two, I would say that once you get to the point where you recognize that you've never finished a painting or you've never finished a piece, you're just finished working on it. And no matter what you do, you're just a certain point, you're finished working on it. It will never be done in that sort of platonic sense. Now I want to counter some of this where I really fundamentally do believe that it's important that we create our art for ourselves. We need to find that joy. We need to find that beauty. And there are some pieces where I will always say, you know what, that piece is just for you. That art is just for you. And if you start out of the gate and you know that that art is just for you, claim that. And you don't have to do anything with it. But don't confuse creating art for somebody else, creating art for the community, creating art to heal and transform and create a more beautiful world with your art just being solely for you. And I think that's where people get tripped up, right? It's perfectly fine to start that art and keep it just for you. And there have been some people in the past where I've said, you know what, for every new piece you start, for every new little creative thing that you start, just either physically or mentally put a not for sale sticker on it, right? And then once you've worked on it a little bit, decide whether you want to keep that sticker on there or not. If you do, that's great. Keep it, not for sale. If you decide you do want to sell it, then do it. And sort of along this line, I would say that if you approach economic transactions, if you're approaching selling as some type of necessary evil, if only we can live without selling, then you miss the beauty of the gift of economics, the gift of being able for me to exchange something that I put my soul in and receive some money back for something that you put your soul in, right? There's that mm-hmm. sacredness that actually happens in exchange that we can honor and celebrate because, you know, there are a lot of different things in which different places people can spend their money. And artists, creatives, tend not to be the best marketers in the world, right? So your work is competing with all sorts of other things with business guys, not unlike myself, that are thinking about the best ways to get somebody to buy that thing. For someone to find your art and fall in love with it and want to buy it from you, man, that's a thing of beauty. That is a thing of beauty. And it, like, embrace that.
Yeah, I agree. I think when you hold on to the painting and pretend it's like just for you, for perfection, you're actually being selfish, because you're not sharing your gift with other people, and by that, like, enhancing their lives as well as yours. You're just keeping everything to yourself.
Yeah, you know, and what I'll say on that one is that's okay too, right? We all need those places in our lives where we feel our own well, right? It could be argued that spending 30 minutes meditating every morning, which, you know, I don't spend always 30 minutes, but I meditate. Like, that's time for me that I could be spent making something for somebody else. And so it can be argued in the same way that that's selfish. But actually, that time is to refuel me, to recharge me, to energize me, so that I can then go out and be in the world in certain ways. So I think art can be like that, right? It doesn't have to be for anything. Now, if all the art that you create, if you get, like, you know, the Scrooge McDuck mansion full of art that you're never going to share with people, I think maybe there's some questions around your self-centeredness there that you might want to spend some time painting about.
I think you should be willing to get paid what you're worth. So instead of having the mindset of, I don't want to sell because, you know, I'm an artist, you should be willing to exchange the value that you're giving somebody else, and in exchange, you're able to create more value.
So my good friend Corey Huff is the founder of The Abundant Artist, and he and I have had many conversations around art. And one of the things that's just so strange about art businesses is that there's no fixed value on art. There's no, like, this whole, what's this painting worth? It's kind of like, you know, it's worth next to nothing until an artist becomes famous, and then it's worth a ridiculous amount of money for no other reason than people want it in that artist. They want it because the artist is famous, right? Mm-hmm. So I understand and have a lot of sensitivity to that, because it's really hard for artists to get to that point of what you're worth, because inevitably that depends upon what somebody else is willing to pay. But here's where I want to say, I think it's important to separate one's personal worth from the worth of their art. And this is something that gets tripped up all the time. So if I'm painting something, or if I'm making a piece of music and someone doesn't like it and they don't want to buy it, you know, it's really easy for me to feel emotionally like they don't like me. They don't want, like, with this thing, like, I'm not good enough. That's not what's being said here, right? Mm-hmm. Your value as a person is different than the value of your art. So if someone walks up and someone, you know, if someone's, like, coming from L.A. and they've got a McMansion and they see your art on the street, and that person might pay $15,000 for this piece that you've got. Another person that lives somewhere else might only want to pay $15 for it. Now, what's the painting worth, or what's the piece worth? Well, on one hand, it's worth $15,000. That's what someone was willing to pay for it. On the other hand, it's worth $15. That's what someone was willing to pay for it. So, you know, once you understand that, and it took me, Kevin, so long to understand that about pricing, that pricing is just a signal for what someone is willing to pay.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It has nothing to do with the intrinsic value of that thing. It's just a signal for what someone is willing to pay in exchange, and that it's fluid. There's a lot of freedom there. If someone buys it for $15,000 and it has that value to them, sell it to them for $15,000, right?
Yeah.
If you think your painting is worth $1,500 and the person that can only pay $15 can't buy it, don't sell it for $15, right? You don't have to. You could sell it for $1,500, but, you know, or $15, but still. I think it's really important to be more detached about this whole value price thing.
Yeah. I was just saying you shouldn't. If you paid like $100 for canvas and then you sell the painting for $50, that doesn't really make any sense.
That makes no sense whatsoever, right? And when you look at it, so you pay $100 for the canvas. You pay, depending upon your paints, you pay $15 to $30 for those paints. You know, all the other random stuff. Let's just, you know, Kevin, you know this better than I do because I don't actually paint, right? But let's just say by the time you have all that related stuff, you're already up to $50, right, in stuff, paints and, you know, cleaners and whatever. So you're at $150 right there. Now, if you were to look at the amount of time that you spent in there, and I don't think enough artists do this, right? Enough professional artists or people who want to get a go of it. If you spend 10 hours painting that and you turn around and sell it for $150, you know, not only have you lost the cost of the materials, but you've lost a lot of time. So, I mean, even if you're going like at a standard $15 an hour, you spend ten hours on that. That's another $150 that you've lost in real time, like that you could have been working somewhere else. And so that's the thing is about as much as we like to make art about the process and about the beauty, as a professional artist, you really have to think about how you're going to make a sustainable go of this. And you can't make a sustainable go with it unless you're charging enough to cover your cost and to make a good living and to pay Uncle Sam and, you know, other business expenses there. And so that's not you being selfish to charge something. That's you ensuring that you have the resources to continue to create this beautiful medicine for the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've heard stories of people who went to like an art fair and they said, oh, I made $500 selling paintings, but the real cost was how much it cost you to get a tent there, how much did it cost to drive there, how much did it cost, you know, to be out there every single day just trying to sell your art? And is that even what you paid in resources just alone to create those paintings?
Yeah, so absolutely. If creating art is a hobby that you're willing to just spend your money to do, I'm all about that. I'm all about hobbies, man. However, if it's a professional way or if it's a way in which you want to create a living, you got to think about the numbers and you got to think about them differently. Cause like what you mentioned is, well, I made $500 revenue. True, but you have negative $250 profit, right? Meaning you lost money in that deal. You can't, unless you've got your business is subsidized by your partner or your parents or society, like you can't continue to do that.
What advice would you give to somebody trying to price their artwork in that situation? Like, how do you even figure out something as complicated as pricing a piece of art?
I would honestly just use market-based pricing in the sense of go to an art fair and see what they're charging, right? Come up with a range. You'll see that there's a range between X and Y, and pick a number. And I know that sounds so arbitrary, but guess what? It's so arbitrary. And there are going to be people who are going to charge for, you know, a little 6x8 picture. They're, you know, people can charge $2,000 for that. There are other people that are going to charge $2. What makes the difference? A lot of it has to do with their fame and so on and so forth. But if you're just getting started, like, you don't have that. And you know, and the reason why market-based pricing in this case is so important is because people are already paying that for art. Right. People, the beauty of art is that it's not like a, you know, supersized fries thing. Right. It's they're not paying like people buy art because they're touched by that art. If they're touched by your art enough to give you $35 and that seems to be what people are paying for art in your region or at that art fair, take the $35, put that $35 price tag on there. Like, understand, though, that many artists are undercharging, so you're inevitably, if you take the median or you take the average of those costs, of those prices, you're inevitably going to be undercharging, given that most artists do, right? So, and again, there are the places I would ask Corey if it were me, right? But But I'd say for any endeavor, whether it's art or anything else, is go out and say, what are people paying for this, right? Because that gives you a good idea of what people are willing to pay if they're already paying for it. If you see this art stand where they've got $50 pieces that are in this format that you paint like close to that, and they just have a line of people like walking up, buying stuff, and walking off, guess what? You can charge $50 too, or whatever they're charging, right? Not, you might not get all of them. They might not like your art, but still. You know, I think, again, when it comes to pricing, we make it way harder than it needs to be, especially in art. Because, for instance, I do business strategy coaching. And it's, in a lot of ways, it's easy for me to quantify and dollarize the value that people are going to get from working with me. I do what I do. I do it well. We see numbers increase, right? Certain types of numbers. I can dollarize that and make it make sense. But art, how do you do that? You can't really. So you have to look at what's going on in the marketplace and have to see that someone's willingness to pay for that art is not a statement of your quote-unquote artistic, you know, like level. It's their willingness to pay for this piece that really moved them in some type of way.
Mm-hmm. I think we could talk about this for a long time. I want to move on to some other things. What do you do as a business strategy coach to help people solve their problems?
First, we figure out what those problems are. Now, and I know that sounds obvious, but people think they have one type of problem when oftentimes they have two or three other types of problems. And I usually don't start with I do start with problems because that's what people show up with. But really looking at, look at their goals. What are you trying to do in this business? How do those goals fit in with your, what we'd say in the business world, your competitive advantages? But what we mean is, those special sets of genius, affinities, talents, expertise, and strengths that make you who you are. And how does those two things fit in with what the market wants or what's out there? Now, we have to be careful because I get this a lot from artists. Like, if I just focus on what the people want, then I'll never actually be able to create art, right? Or create my thing. Almost all art falls within certain lineages and categories. If people, like, I'm in Portland, and there's just a certain type of art here in Portland. It's not my thing, but it's apparently a lot of people's things because they're buying it and painting it, right? Mm-hmm. So if you have, like, Portland-style art, then, like, there are just people who are going to pay a certain amount, and you're going to fit within a certain lineage, as it were. So there's that part of it. It's that nexus of where are you trying to take this business? What are your particular strengths and what does the market want? And when you get those alignment, you get a certain set of opportunities. Once you have those opportunities, you can line them up with like, okay, so what are you trying? What's not working? Which creates their problems and challenges? And then it's just, and I know it sounds, maybe it sounds really abstract, but it's just lining up those opportunities in ways that help them overcome those challenges and also leverage their strengths. That's really what it's about. So in a nutshell, that's what I do. Now, it comes with a lot of industry experience. It comes with a lot of, like, figuring out how to find opportunities in the marketplace. And just, you know, being a good strategist is actually being able to see in a different way. And that is so hard to explain to people until you get it. But like, it's just that art of seeing and seeing how to take what you see and convert it into some type of action.
Is there a process that you can take people through to see, to have them see better? Or is it just something that is built into you?
I think it's both, right? This is fundamentally, it's a trainable thing. We train people every day. Like, we as a nation, when you look at our, you know, armed forces, train some of the best strategists in the world. We train this in business every day as a society. So if you ever think that it's some of those innate skills that you have or you don't, it's not quite true. So there are great tools. There's like the SWOT analysis, which a lot of people know about. You can look at it for Wikipedia, which gives you a different framework for looking at that. There's also another tool called the PEST tool, which is political, economic, social, and technological, just different factors that force that. There's the five forces model by Michael Porter. But like, you can go down and like a strategist have come up with a lot of these different tools like that to assess opportunities. So, and it's going through that. Now, the thing about it is, part of what makes a good strategist and part of what makes a good entrepreneur is having a rich repository of cases. I've read at this point, thousands of different cases of military operations, of business case studies, of political changes. I'm always reading about how do people make change happen. What were the forces that made it? Why does this work that way? So there's just a lot of reading and experience. And then there's also a lot of application. I've worked with a lot of clients, and I keep stressing a lot, because I don't want to go into, whether it's 432 or 567, but we're talking in the hundreds of businesses and in the thousands of students about what works and what doesn't work. So there's that type of thing that I can't teach, because I just see Kevin's situation looks very close to Amy's situation from 2 years ago. And here's how we solved it then. And it worked really well. In Amy's case, looked like John's case, which I read about in this book over in business, but it also is very similar to this one battle campaign that I read, right? No, it sounds, you see all those connections, but again, strategy is really about the art of seeing.
Mm-hmm. I think that also ties into being creative in general, is just taking all the knowledge that you have and figuring out how can I apply it to this particular situation, as opposed to this is just an individual event that happened and forgetting about it.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of creative people just really can be powerful strategic thinkers, because, it goes back to collecting, connecting, and sharing the dots, right? So we're able to collect the dots and share the dots. And that's a lot of the art of strategy as well, is just being able to see that here's what's unique about this situation, and it's similar to this other situation, start to connect those dots. So, and that's why so many creative people end up becoming fantastic entrepreneurs, especially if they can get their mindset right about marketing, selling, and strategy.
I think the interesting thing is, if they actually took the time to explore it, they would find a lot of similarities in the way strategy is similar to creative work.
Absolutely. Absolutely. A lot of my work, actually, Kevin, here's a secret, right? I'll read something about how to create, how to paint something. I'm not a painter in the sense of I don't paint, right? But I'll read about that, and it's like, they have this whole framework for how to create this piece. How is that similar to what we might do if we're creating something in business? Or I might look at the way somebody puts up a tool shed, and it's like, what can I learn from that I apply over here? So there's a lot of that that's just so much about that's very similar to how someone might walk through a museum and get inspiration from what they're seeing, or they might walk down the street and get inspiration from something, and they seem, that's kind of close to this idea, but what if I just changed it this way a little bit? And it's just fundamentally the same processes.
Yeah. Almost everything that has been done before has been based off of something else that has already happened. They might not know about it, but in some way you're influenced by everything that you see, do, and hear, whatever. And that influences the way that you approach every situation.
Yeah, I always tune out when a creative person is like, this is 100% original. because usually what I think is, you're not very well versed in this field, right? To understand that, because there's I can't think of an innovation, or I can't think of an art innovation that was 100% original, like in that way. And I think that's where a lot of artists can get in trouble, because we focus so much on originality and understand that some people want really, really original and new ways of looking at things because they don't want art like everyone else. And there's a wide swath of buyers who like a picture of a border collie, right? and there's all sorts of ways you can make painting a border collie really interesting and different and artistic. But so many people are like, I want to create this hyper-modern, you know, I don't even know the words because I'm not a painter, but you know what I'm saying. Like, we see this in all fields. Like, I want to use these, you know, deconstructivist theories, blah, 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 to make this thing that nobody has ever seen before. Okay. There's room for that. If you're really doing that as a creative exploration for yourself, that's fantastic. And understand that the reason why so many American food establishments have fries is because a lot of freaking people want to eat fries.
Mm-hmm.
And there's nothing wrong with those joints for selling fries. They know that to serve customers' needs, they need to have that. So there might be this balance that you can have. And I know there's all sorts of artists at this point who are listening to this and are like, I really don't like this guy because he's making me sacrifice my art for making a sale. Not at all. I'm just wanting you to be really clear about the art that you're creating and who it serves. If it's serving you, do whatever the hell you want that serves you. If you're trying to have it serve, transform, and really add beauty for other people's lives, be clear about that and have the humility and the service ethic to go into where people are and say, you know what, for them to receive this, maybe it would be good if I include this element that they really like.
Mm-hmm. I think it's all about knowing when to employ your creativity into, like you said, making it for yourself, because creative exploration is how we work out a lot of the kinks.
Mm-hmm.
No one will ever see those things, and that's fine. And it just allows you to experiment. And then knowing when, if you want to make something that people want to buy, you have to know the market and your idea of what's resonates with you as an artist can fit the market.
Yeah.
There's no reason to reinvent the wheel if you don't have to.
Yeah, it can fit a market. It can fit the market, right? So a market would just be finding where people who like the type of art that you like to create, like where do they shop and buy, and just make sure that your art's there. And I know that sounds really obvious, but it's so easily forgotten, right? We live in a world of just, you know, the long tail where for any given interest, for any given desire, there's a marketplace somewhere. You just have to find that marketplace. If that sounds all techno-savvy, futuristic, and you just want to, like, stay hyper-local, then you might be more bound to create art that matches the taste of people and find that space, find that place in the art itself where there's a smile in the mind for you because you saw something in there. And I think about that because I do a lot of blogging. And sometimes blogging is not the most artistic affair, right? There's certain formats that work really, really well. And there's certain ways of saying things that work really, really well. And I'm aware of that. But there's almost every post to where there's a few sentences or there's a few phrases where I just really I want it to be – I wanted to have a certain rhythm. I wanted to have this alliteration. I wanted to have this allusion to something else. And I'll spend, you know, I might spend an hour writing and drafting, but I might spend another 30 minutes just honing those little pieces that might just be for me, right? No one else might ever see them. But when I look back at that post, I have that smile in my own mind about that piece, like, oh yeah, I remember that. That was a fun problem, or that was a fun way of saying that, or I'm so glad that I spent that extra time on that piece. On that, you know, and it could be, Kevin, it could be 8 words, you know,
mm-hmm.
but those 8 words made it art for me.
Yeah, it's about the craft versus the result, and they don't have to be the same thing.
Exactly. And my 8 words, I'm a writer, I'm a speaker, right? My 8 words could be, you know, your pigments that you use. It could be your textures that you use in places that are just really your own way of making that border collie fit, you know, that border collie painting really be the way you paint the border collie, right? The way that it showed up for you and made you feel.
I think a very good article for not just artists, but everybody to read is the 1,000 True Fans by Kevin Kelly. You mentioned the long tail earlier.
Absolutely, yeah.
That article pretty much explains how you can just take 1,000, all it takes is 1,000 people who will absolutely buy anything that you create. And once you have those people, you can create whatever you want.
You can. You can create whatever you want. And now we're talking sort of in the online space. So, but I think it's true for all our businesses. Like sometimes when you go to that business, it's always about like customers and more customers, more customers. But we don't realize that it's a bit of a ground war, right? Where it's one at a time. No matter what you do, you make a sale one person at a time. And whether that sale, because you're on a, you know, hyper internet launch, whether that sale is every 6 seconds somebody is buying something, or whether it's, you know, a slower pace where every 6 days somebody is buying something, you create a customer. You create a relationship of value with people one person at a time. So as long as you take that approach to it and you're like, okay, I need 1,000. What am I creating today? How am I connecting with people today? Like, what am I doing today to create that relationship with someone today? You know, and if you did that every day, you know, it's not like you have a sale a day, but if you did it every day, you know, over a course of 3 to 5 years, you have that 1,000 true fans that then you can do all sorts of things with. And you don't get those fans by half finishing paintings. You don't get those fans by half writing songs. You don't get those fans by half finishing quilts. Whatever art you have, you don't get those fans and customers by the stuff you don't, with the stuff you don't finish.
Mm-hmm. I think, I don't remember who said it, but it's constantly said, and it's done is better than finished. I mean, finished is better than, you know, done is better than. Now I can't even remember it.
Yeah, the way I say it is good enough and done is better than perfect and pending.
Yeah, something like that. I can't remember what the exact one I was thinking of, but it's the essence is that releasing something that isn't perfect is better than not releasing it at all.
Exactly. Exactly. You know, and the thing about it is we all think that I'm going to sound morbid here, but just recent events got me thinking about this. We all think that we have some time in the future to share our work. We all think that there's some period in which, like, you'll finish it, you'll get it out there in the world, and then, like, I don't know what happens, like manna falls from heaven or something. But life is incredibly short. Life can end in an instant. And not just your life as the artist, but someone who goes too soon or goes in a tragic way who may have benefited from your art, right? And so I've said it multiple times because I, as much as I'm not like a fine artist, I don't paint, I don't do a lot of that, I consider myself as a writer and as a speaker as an artist. And art transforms people. It changes people. It heals people. We have a world that's full of frustration and heartache. And art helps. And it's our job as artists to get out there in the street and get our medicine to the people who need it, not for those people who are depressed on the couch, who are stricken with grief, who are bedridden, to find ways to find us.
What are some of the most common problems that you see with people who are trying to run a business?
Well, we've already talked about the pricing and not charging enough. That's a fundamental problem. I think there's the classic Field of Dreams problem as well. Like if you make something that's really cool, people will come and buy it. Doesn't work out so well. It's your job to go out and find them. Not delegating and not actually like figuring out how to have other people help you inside your business is another critical problem. Now, part of that is predicated on not earning enough to pay yourself. If you're not earning enough to pay yourself, you can't pay somebody else. right? So those are intimately tied together. Let me think. Those are kind of the top three that I see. I think not having the ability to go out in the marketplace and see what's being done without going into compare and despair ends up crippling a lot of people, because you end up creating in a vacuum. So that would be another one of those things I would put on the table as well.
If you were just starting out, what would be the like first three steps that you would do to start a business?
I'm going to have to be in integrity here because, you know, given my story, I didn't actually set out to start a business in that way. So I could look at it that way. So I would probably do it all backwards, like, because that's what I did the first time. Actually, that's not true. I've started businesses after that. So the first thing that I would do, first step I would do is really take an assessment of myself and what I can offer and find the places where people are buying that type of thing. That'd be the first step. Very demand oriented in the sense of like, it's rather than go out and dig a hole, like fill a hole that's already there. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
And so that would be the first thing that I would do. The second thing that I would do, honestly, is start a website, because it's just a prerequisite at this point. It's such an easy way to share your work. The third that I would do is relentlessly like converse with people and let them know how much I care about what they're doing. Like, I don't know, like, it sounds funny to say like converse more and care more. It turns out that it really works, you know?
Uh-huh.
And so people buy in a business context, they buy because they know, like, and trust you. They know, like, and trust you. If you're not out there talking to folks, they can't know you. If you don't care about them, they probably don't like and trust you either, right? And so that's what I would do. Granted, you know, it would be unlikely that I would start an art business given who I am, but I think the principles remain the same, right? You find, you look at what type of art you're good at. You look at what people are buying, you find a match. You get your art in a place where people can see it, and you get that going. And then third is you show your passion and care and how much about the art and connect with people who care about those same types of things. You know, it reminds me of a verse from the Tao Te Ching. It goes something like this. I'll paraphrase it. It's, the Tao is broad and plain, but people prefer the side paths. Now, what that means is that, like, what it takes to be in accord with the way of nature when we're talking about the Tao, or to be successful in business, is actually pretty simple. It's pretty laid out.
Mm-hmm.
But people like to go, like, and do their own thing and come up with a new way of doing it. And when that works, it works big. When it doesn't, then, you know, it's a long and hard way.
Yeah. I think it's all about aligning what you do well and finding the people who want what you do well and matching that and having them essentially know you, like you said, so that they will buy from you, because you're not going to buy from some random guy off the street. You're going to want to know some more about the people that you're buying from.
I mean, you might buy something off the street, because he might be selling something that just really lights you up, right? I've bought stuff from guys off the street because what they were selling was fantastic.
That's the exception.
That's the exception to the rule.
Something right. That people want no matter what. Like, they don't care who's selling it or what, you know.
But I mean, I think it's one of those things where it sounds creepy, but at a certain point, and this is why certain types of art like goes through the roof, is that people are buying a piece of you every time, right? They're buying a piece of the way you see the world, the way it comes together, so on and so forth. And they want to buy something that they sort of, again, know, like, and trust. Like, there are the outliers in which people will buy art, or they'll buy stuff from people that they absolutely despise. you know, but take whatever group that you don't like. It could be the KKK, it could be the NRA, it could be now whoever. And imagine like one of their leaders creating art and putting it out on the market. How likely are you to buy that?
If you don't know the person, maybe.
If you don't know the person, maybe you'd buy it. But if you knew that this person who you just despise what they stand for created this, you're really less likely to buy that.
Yeah.
So the converse is true. If someone you absolutely love, like, you know, I think of my boy Jack Johnson. We're not actually friends. I just pretend friends, right? But, like, I just like the guy. I like him. You're right. He's a good dad. He creates this really good music. Even when he creates albums, they're like, I'm like, ah, I could have, like, ah, I don't know about that one. Like, I still feel good about the purchase because I'm supporting Jack, you know, me and the millions of other people. But still, me, right, and Jack, we got a thing, right? So, you know, that's what it's like. And there are people who will buy your art because they love your art and they want to support you.
I think that's why something like Patreon is such a huge step in the way of artists reaching their fans and being able to create work and not necessarily have it be based on a single product. It's just like an ongoing patronage like they used to do back in the day, you know, the Renaissance.
Yeah, that's why we have so much of the Renaissance art, is because there were rich guys that were like, you know, I don't know what you're going to create, but I believe in you. So how about you live here on a nice, healthy stipend and create stuff? Right. And so that's basically how that worked, folks. And it worked really well. And we kind of got away from that with the commercial art complex. But now you're absolutely right. We're back to where, you know, it doesn't take a Bill Gates level of wealth to hire an artist when there could be, you know, 1,000 of us that will give an artist $6 a month to create something.
Mm-hmm. So what are you currently working on, and where do you see yourself taking what you do in your business and your future, essentially?
Oh, the future. You know, I ordered the crystal ball from Amazon a few weeks ago, but it still hasn't gotten here. Anyways, no, so as I mentioned earlier, I'm finishing a book. The name of that book is tentatively Start Finishing, How to Create Your Best Work and Thrive in the New World of Projects. That one's going to be a few years before it hits the shelves. And that's one of many series of books that are sort of in that arc. So that I'm really excited about that because I really want to be someone who helps other people create. That's what I do, but I want to do it at that scale where more people are doing their best work. And that's exciting. We've got some events coming up that are for thought leaders and other entrepreneurs. That's exciting. When people ask me, like, what would you, you know, those are just questions, Kevin, like, what would you do if you had $1 billion, right? $1 billion. Well, it would be versions of what I'm doing now, just at a different level of game, you know? Mm-hmm. I love what I do. I love who I do it with. And I'm really excited about what comes up even when I can't see it.
Yeah. So some people will just lay back and go to an island or something, but they'll quickly figure out that that gets tiring.
I would, you know, I'm not, I don't actually understand the concept of retirement at this point. I know I'm 35. Maybe I will when I'm 75, but why would you, like, if you find that way of doing what you're good at, what you'd love to do that serves other people, why would you stop? You know? And whether that's through your art, through your painting, whether that's music, you know, mine is through writing and business consulting and speaking. Like, why would I stop that? I would just want to do it more, right? And do it at a level of exposure and impact that it gets it gets my version of what I do out to the people who need it. Because there are a lot of people, there are so many people who need the product of art. Right. And there are so many people who need the process of creativity to heal themselves and heal those around them. So that's what I'm about.
Yeah. So it's about aligning the two groups together.
Yeah, absolutely.
I got a couple more questions left. The first is, do you have a morning routine? And if you do, what is it?
I do have a morning routine. It starts with being yelled at by cats because they're hungry. I don't like that part of the routine, but, you know, that's just part of it. But after I get them fed or situated, then I meditate for about 15 to 30 minutes. I'll then transfer to creating sort of what I'm going to do for the day. And then I go do what I just said I was going to do and do that for a few hours. And then I switch into speaking and coaching and things like that. But yeah, the bedrock of my morning is actually meditation.
Hmm. What kinds of things have you discovered while meditating?
I could be doing it wrong, but I've not had one of those Fantasia experiences, you know? What meditation does for me is it's not so much about what happens while you're sitting there. It's what's happening when you're not. It creates a level of presence and clarity of mind that really sets you off on the right foot at the same time that no matter what happens during the day, you could return to that place, return to that groundedness and really decide to live life and consciously live life. I'll use Susan Pivers, who's one of my friends, and she's also a meditation teacher and Buddhist, allows you to live with an open heart, right? And that's the benefit for me, is that it gives you those resources to remain calm and focused and really present to what's available. And so most of the benefit of meditation comes when you're not sitting there versus when you are, because meditation is like, it's actually pretty boring. You sit there. Mm-hmm. You know, you've got a guided meditation. You got some person you've never met telling you what to do, or you're just sitting there with your own thoughts and your thoughts do your own thing. And, you know, there are different traditions about whether you try to extinguish your thoughts or whether you just let your thoughts be. So I'm not going to get into the different types of meditation. But fundamentally, like, I think people, when it comes to meditation, think that it is that sort of, it, you know, place where you get epiphanies and you have that Fantasia moment. But really, it's a lot of sitting.
Yeah, I do like 5 minutes a day, so not quite at the 30-minute level. And I don't think there is a wrong way to meditate, except for not doing it, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know. You know, Casey Carter, Christopher Carter from This Epic Life, I think he's up to meditating for 90 minutes a day.
Whoa.
Yeah, and so I don't know. Maybe I should ask him, like, hey, man, is there like a tipping point at like 62 minutes that the wild and interesting thing happens, or is it just more sitting?
I keep on hearing about transcendental meditation, but I'm not quite sure what about it is so spectacular.
That clearly you and I are doing it wrong.
Well, I guess we'll never figure it out unless we try that, right?
Yeah.
Do you have any book, tool, or resource recommendations for people on being more creative?
No. And here's why. I don't know, especially for the people listening here, and most of the people that I talk to, like, we don't actually need to be more creative. I think we need to have better ways of channeling our creativity. And so so I don't have any books that I have framed as, like, how to be more creative. Lots of books on how to do something with your creativity, though. What are some of those? So I love, as far as writing goes, I'm a huge fan of On Writing by Stephen King. That's a great one. Not so much a fan. I like some of The War of Art. That's a good one for writing. I'm looking at my shelf right now, so that's why my voice might sound funny. But anyways, Bird by Bird is another great one that I just love. A lot of them tend to be like Flow by Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi, that really talks about that. Twilight Tharp's got The Creative Habit. So those are the ones that I would go to for specifically creative people. I think Seven Habits is a great book as far as really living principles, getting things done. I think is a great book as well. Most of the people who would identify as creative might want to jump off a bridge when they read it. So if you had that experience, it's not just you. You asked for one book. Sorry, I gave like six. Sorry about that.
No, I was looking for as many as you wanted to give.
Okay. We can be here all night.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's good because a lot of those I've heard repeated time after time, and that shows that they are books that should be read.
Yeah. There's one. Give me a second. There's something niggling at me here. I think it's The Power of Progress. See, this is the problem when you have Kindle books, is that I forget the names a lot easier than when I'm looking at them. So it's either The Power to Have It or The Progress Principle. I think it's The Progress Principle. What I love about The Progress Principle is that the assertion there is that it's not so much about like finishing, but it's about that progress every day of that. So I know I've talked a lot about finishing, and I've got a book coming out called Start Finishing, right? And I think where why it's called Start Finishing is it's not just about the finishing, it's about the start and then keeping that continual progress, and that's a process, right? Of every day we have to get up and start finishing whatever we started, right? And start finishing whatever's in front of us today. And what I love about the progress principle, especially for creative people, is we tend to come up with these monolithic plans of like, or just huge plans of what we're going to do in the world, and then we don't do them, and we end up being frustrated. Whereas I think if we focus more on how every day we're showing up and getting one step closer, that we can find that inherent motivation that comes from progress, and we can find that inherent confidence that comes from every day getting closer by manifesting your creativity and making a difference in the world.
Mm-hmm. I think the only way to continue to be creative is that constant daily act, because without that, when you sit idle, you kind of lose it.
Yeah, I mean, very simply, create or die.
Mm-hmm. I think Todd Henry's Die Empty is along about those lines.
Yeah, his is about making sure that you don't really pass with so much of your creativity inside you. But it's largely saying the same thing. I don't know. You know, we as humans are so fascinated with death in different ways. But that's that final point to where, like, you know, the game is over on this material plane. And so what have you done with it? And I like to think about days as that sort of checkpoint. Is like, you know, as I'm crossing into going into dinner and you know, as I'm hanging out with my wife, and then as I'm later on prepping my mind for sleep, you know, I'm kind of like, what did I do with this day that I was given, this beautiful, blessed day that I woke up with? What did I do with it? And am I happy with that? And most of the time, I'm pretty happy with it. Sometimes I'm like, no, not so much, right? But every day is that sort of catalytic moment to say, what did I do with this precious, beautiful time that I have?
Yeah, there's no guarantee of tomorrow. So what can you do today to, like, make the best of what you have?
Exactly.
Who is somebody that you personally know that is extremely creative, and then somebody that you don't personally know that is also creative?
Someone that I know that's especially creative. Probably one of the most creative guys I know is also a little bit on the batshit crazy side, and I say that with love, is Chase Reeves from Fizzle. One of the most creative guys I don't know, or creative people I don't know. I'll have to think about that one, actually. What's tripping me up here is the most creative. It's kind of like my response to be more creative. I tend to think in terms of prolific, in terms of rather than creative itself. So So if I were to go with prolific, it would be James Patterson. Because that dude, I don't know how.
Gosh.
Man. Whew. Okay. So if we're talking on that front, then I would have to go with James Patterson. Because that guy breathes and a book pops out.
Yeah, you can interpret it however you want to.
Yeah. Okay. So yeah, I'll go with James Patterson. Maria Popova is actually really, really creative too, and prolific.
Yeah, those are all good. Yeah, I agree. My last question is, what is your definition of creativity and what can people do to be more creative?
What I would say is creativity, it's very broad, is human energy channeled to deliver delights or solve problems. So that's the first part. What was the second part of the question?
How can people be more creative?
Use what they have, man. Like, we all have the capability to deliver delights to people, and we all have the ability to look at our surroundings and say, hey, in what way can I make this space more beneficial, useful, beautiful, harmonious, relaxing for me, right? And I think that's one of those things that, you know, some animals have it as well. But what really makes humans unique is that we see the world and see how the world could be, and we make the gap. We mine that gap and change the world that is to the world that could be. And so how do you be more creative? Use it, right? Do that. Find those moments every day, every hour, to use this incredible gift that we have of time, of each other, and these especially ensouled human faculties.
Yeah, I think there has never been a time where it's as easy to do creative things than it is right now.
Yeah, I mean, there's no mode in history, so we live in a paradoxical times. There's no point in history to where we have more options to create an economic livelihood for ourselves, right? You can do a lot of things. You can live in Nigeria and be someone who, you know, works in American companies. The world is wide open. At the same time, for Americans, cost of living is higher than it's ever been. So you have to do more to create a livelihood. But I agree with you. There's never been a time in history to where we have the ability to find those super geeks, those aficionados, those nerds that love what we do and connect with them than there is right now. And so, you know, and there's never been as much information available about exactly how to do that. There's no shortage of information from Google that, you know, Google and the web engines and just stuff that's being created on how to do that. I think what we as people need to, we need to level up our courage and compassion to match the creative capabilities that are just right in front of us.
That's a very good way to end this. Charlie, it's been really awesome talking to you. I think people, especially artists out there, can get a lot of great tips on, you know, just mindset and how to approach their art and just think about things that they might not have thought of before.
Thanks so much for having me, and it's been a blast, bud.
Where can people find you or keep up to date with what you're doing?
Okay, so all roads for Charlie Gilkey lead to productiveflourishing.com. If you're one of the Twitterati, you can join me at Charlie Gilkey. Either one, most of my body of work lives at productiveflourishing.com, though, and I look forward to connecting with you.
Cool. Well, thanks again, Charlie.
Thanks, Kevin. Have a great day.
You too.
And that's it for the 42nd episode of Cracking Creativity. For show notes, go to crackingcreativity.org/42. If you like this episode, subscribe to the show on iTunes at crackingcreativity.org/subscribe. Also, feel free to write a review or leave me a comment about the show. Hope this stoked your creative fires, and I'll see you next time on Cracking Creativity.